Hello everyone and welcome to Digipod at Wembley Stadium. We are celebrating the 1 year anniversary of Digipod going live across all of our social networks and all of our streaming platforms. And today I'm delighted to be joined by a live studio audience. On cue as well, love that. And of course, my guest for today is actually Mr. Jack Stenson. And Jack, you are the head of scouting for BT Startups, right?
In Europe, yep.
Yep, awesome. Yep. So welcome onto That Digipod live at Wembley.
Thank you very much, great to be here.
Nice one. And we've got a fun story actually, because this is where we actually met for the very first time, Jack, if I'm sure you'll remember.
Yeah.
Right? So what was the concert again? Just remind me.
We were at a Wild Night of Westlife.
We were indeed.
Here at Wembley. And yeah, tore the place up. It was a night to be remembered.
Yeah. And obviously I was doing a lot of networking there and managed to persuade you to come on to the pod. So
twist my arm to come back to Wembley. Yeah. Tough gig.
Real tough gig. So hopefully we can do, you know, a little bit better than Westlife did that night. A bit, no pressure, man, but let's try and do it. So Jack, a lot of people won't know about the division that you're actually in at BT, because it is a new division as well. It's only been around for about a year. So do you mind just giving a bit of an overview into what your role is?
Sure. So I'm in Etcetera, which was previously known as Incubation in Digital. It's head up by Tom Guy. And what Etcetera is doing is creating, investing, and amplifying in startups. So say in health tech, drones, fintech, we're creating new startups to create new revenues and new markets and new industries for BT beyond the world of telco. And my team, which is head up by Meg Blight, is the startup partnership and investment team. And what we do is we find startups where we can do a partnership deal with them to create those new revenues with an existing partner. So resell their products or some sort of partnership deal. And sometimes where there is a strategic benefit, we'll also invest maybe cash in them as well. So right now I'm in the middle of closing a multi-million pound deal in the drones industry. So any day now. But it's a great team. Yeah, we're just less than a year old, but we're growing really fast. And it's a great bunch of people. Luckily, I get to work with.
That's so cool. And we've talked before, and a lot of people don't know that this is an area for BT, which is, you know, really new. And it doesn't seem like this is something that BT would do. And you've been in the company for about 7 months now.
Yeah.
What attracted you to BT?
So previously, before I joined BT, I was in a health tech startup. And I was actually doing in the early stages of a partnership conversation with my now boss, Meg. And the fit wasn't right for the startup and BT at the time. But when I, after a couple of conversations with her and I got to know other people in the team, my eyes were open to what BT was doing and the scale of the efforts in innovation beyond what I assumed was just broadband and EE, you know, naturally.
Yeah.
And, you know, really opened my eyes to what was going on. I stayed in touch with Meg. We ended up meeting again at the Web Summit in Lisbon, a big startup tech conference. And then she mentioned at the time that she was hiring for head of startup scouting for Europe, as well as a few other roles. And immediately I threw my my hat in the ring. And I'm delighted. I joined in January, and it's a dream role for me. So, yeah.
Nice. And so Meg poached you effectively to a certain degree.
She made
degree.
Me aware. and then I very much initiated that, yes.
Okay, cool. And where did your passion for being involved in startups come from? What was your day one?
So I began my career in consulting. So I started off in strategy consulting in Dublin in a big firm, and in Accenture Strategy Consulting. And I think at the time I thought strategy was the place where for you to manifest ideas and manifest innovation, it was strategy. And it was coming up with the ideas, doing the research, and then you were part of the journey of innovation because you created the idea. And then as I went on through my career in consulting, I realized that, well, actually, no, it's the product work. It's the early stage prototyping. That's when it starts to become real. So I got more into this. And I ended up joining a smaller firm. I ended up in New York as well, doing that in a smaller firm. And then I realized that, well, when I do this for a client, I end up leaving before it really becomes real, because we did the early stage prototype and we'd hand it over to the client, and then they'd scale it up and make it a success story. And I'd be gone by that point. So I really realized that I really want to be part of the journey of the manifestation of innovation. And so that's when I previously tried to found two startups myself, very proud to call myself a failed founder for trying to do that. And then when I previously tried to create the second one in New York. When I came back from New York, I decided that I'd just go into a startup that was already there. So I ended up joining an existing company. And then being part of a single company, I didn't feel like the impact was enough. So then, as I said, I met Meg and I learned that this role at BT would enable me to do the project-based work that I loved in consulting, while also being very much part of the success story of startups, but then also staying part of their journey. So the deal I'm doing now in the drones industry, I'll be staying in touch with them once a quarter at least, to make sure that this deal stays as we intend and we can expand and grow on it. And we'll be hosting them at events. And so very much staying part of their success story going forward. So that's my last 12 years, I suppose. Yeah.
No, that's so cool. And you mentioned your time in New York there, and you know, you're building up a couple of startups yourself, which maybe didn't go quite the way you wanted. But can you talk to me a little bit about a couple of the ones that you that you built up from the scratch, and you know, what was the reasons maybe why it didn't quite kick off?
Sure. So the more recent one in New York was fake news was a zeitgeist term in 2018. A bit more than it is now. It's still a problem now, or people calling stuff fake news. But I was with my firm. We were hosting a festival innovation in Central Park in New York. We had a lot of C-suite attendees, media clients being a big group of our clients in New York. So I was trying to think, how do we do a art of the possible promotion of what our consulting firm can do in New York? So we created the No Fake News Fake Newsroom, which is a news anchor desk with a microphone plonked on it, and people would come up and talk crap to it. And within a really, really limited set of facts. So we gave them like a cheat sheet, basically. We're like, you talk about these things, you'll be fact-checked. So people come up, talk crap to it. And on the screens behind me, it would say a live transcript on one side. And on the other side, it would say, oh, you said this. And here's a fact that conflicts with it. So we had some senior attendees from various companies in New York, media companies. And one of them from Dow Jones Wall Street Journal, their chief technology officer, was like, cool, when can we get my journalists using this thing? We're like, well, we're a consulting firm. We don't build products, and we hadn't done at that point. And thus began kind of a long hustle in New York for me, where I tried to convince my firm to let me spin off this technology, create a legal entity for us to create this startup. This firm hadn't done that before. So with the best of intentions, it didn't work out on everyone's part. But I ended up spending about 6-7 months working with like the finest minds in journalism in New York, London, Dublin, really understanding if we were going to create an AI sidekick for journalists to help them, not just for fact checking, but for not relying on Twitter as a crutch and relying on that as a secondhand source of information for breaking news stories. We created something that could solve for those problems. We got to an early stage, to like a late alpha, not to quite to beta stage. And we had companies like NBC signed up as to be a customer if we got some investors on board, but I couldn't quite extract it from the company. But it really gave me a real thirst to just launch fully into the startup world. And I think you mentioned passion a while ago, and I would very much consider, and I'm very aware through my career, that passion is as much a liability at times as it is an asset. Because when I was an early stage junior person in consulting, I would often know what I didn't want to do more than what I did want to do. So my first 2 years in consulting was the Irish banks were in the doldrums, and it was very much helping that out. And while I was really proud of the work that we did in helping, you know, solve a key problem in the Irish economy, it was very tough and depressing putting safety nets in for mortgages. You're living really seeing you're living the problem quite a lot. So I knew what I didn't want to do more than what I did. So I would often push back and say, I don't want to be a mortgage specialist. I don't want to be this. I don't want to be in this. I don't want to be in that. So knowing what I didn't want to do, knowing that I want to be part of innovation, but not sure how best.
So you had a clear vision in your mind, and you would quite easily go back to your bosses to say, this isn't something I believe in that I want to work on.
Yeah, and when you have someone who spent 20 years in that space and you're like, I don't want to be you. I like you. I respect you. And there's some people who I thought were geniuses, but I didn't want to be a supply chain expert.
No, which is completely fair enough, right? If you're passionate about something, you're going to do the best job at it at the end of the day. And I'm really interested to know about the initial sort of user need idea concept when you came up with like fake news for example, how difficult is it to like say there's a market here that I need to sort of tap into, and what the killer use cases would be to actually go and implement something like that?
Sure. So I think the key things for any product success, green ingredients for any product success, are focus on the problem, stay in the problem, don't leave the problem, and don't try and solutionize. What are the connected things to this problem? How many problems are in this space? I interviewed 70, 80 people who were the CEO of Reuters, senior people in BBC, New York Times, etc. And for weeks, stayed in the problem. What are the problems you face? They're connected to this space. And focusing on the problem. The second thing I'd say is a guy called Brian Balfour, B-A-L-F-O-U-R, has a thing he calls the Four Fits Framework for product, which some people might know of. Him and Andrew Chen, I think, are the two really good guys if you're looking to learn more about products and what makes success in products, especially in scaling up something that exists. But Brian has the Four Fits Framework, which is, it's understanding that the product relies on the market as much as the business model, as much as the channel you sell it in, and it's all interconnected. And it's about finding strategic fitness in when you do have your idea or your solution for what you think will solve those problems, making sure that it integrates well and it harmoniously works as a business. So the way you sell it, who you're selling it to, the pricing, the strategy. And so I think the Four Fits Framework is a good sort of canvas on a page approach to testing if everything fits well or if one piece is missing.
Yeah, and how much influence is needed when you go into, because I've definitely had it in my career, we're working on a product, for example, some people really believe in it, some people don't. You then have to go back with, is this a market fit? Is this commercially viable? Does it meet a user need? How hard was it for you or in your experience, how hard is it to sort of influence people to get buy-in?
There are, in everything in life, there are always, you can kind of put people in buckets where, and the one in particular, there's two in particular here you need to be aware of, I think. One of my bosses in New York, a good friend of mine, my boss in New York, in the consulting firm used to say is the person who throws the grenade into the room. So you have someone who's in a workshop and someone who's just going to like throw a grenade into the room. But if you go meet that person before the meeting and you kind of sit down and learn their concerns, and sometimes they just want to express their opinion. They don't need to do it in the workshop if they've expressed it before and you show that you've taken that into consideration. So identifying who's going to throw a grenade in the mix and blow up the meeting and the plans and the schedule, the agenda and your goals and your hopes and dreams, engage them first. Other people may want to kind of just talk a lot. Engaging them before as well can be quite helpful. It's focusing on the problems of the people as well. So like you have stakeholders with various agendas, goals that can conflict, and it's about engaging them up front. Don't delay and wait until the last minute hoping they'll go away, because they probably won't.
Yeah. Would you say in your current role, you're kind of on the other side now of that with people coming to you? So what are you looking for when, people are, not to use the term, use the term pitching effectively to BT, but we also want to help them. Like what kind of things are you looking for? What sort of, is going to make them click?
So in terms of the challenges we're looking to solve, like the drones one came from Philip. So he decided that we wanted to be in the drone space. So when the CEO asks you to do something, cool. We're on that, buddy. Often it's a brief from some senior leader across the business, or we have our strategy and research teams who identify that this is a space that's hot or that we could create something compelling in. So it can kind of come from any space. In terms of what we're looking for, there's a list of 40 questions that we might ask a startup to try and get under the hood of what they're building, their business, their team, their culture. We want to make sure that they don't have server farms in North Korea or that they're funded by Vladimir Putin.
Yeah.
We want to make sure culturally that they're someone we want to work with for years at a time. And then there's the products and the business and the solution they solve for and everything as well. So there's so much to consider. We usually start off with in the startup partnerships and investment team. We have a challenge. We'll start with a long list of startups. We have scouting partners who will help us gather maybe dozens, could be 100 startups initially, and then we'll whittle that down. We won't engage those startups though, because one of the things I'm really proud of is that a lot of the people in Etc. actually were ex-founders or worked in startups before. And what that it gives them is a mindset and an appreciation of the pressures and the stresses that goes with being in a startup. So for example, when we engage startups now, I always tell startups, I know you want to pitch to BT. I know that would be like a badge of honor and you think it could open doors, but unless I know there's value for you, I'm not going to let you pitch to us because your time is more precious than my time.
Yep.
A startup's founder's time is infinitely more valuable than mine. And I tell that to my team as well, who, whenever they go meet startups, you know, keep that in mind because we don't have this brand and reputation in the startup space in the UK or anywhere else. So if we're going to build that, let's do it right and start from a place of respect for the startup and be the partner that we want to be the whole way through the journey. And have those guiding principles as we build our brand and reputation as the best startup a partner can have.
Wow, and that's kind of a mission for the Etcetera team. That's a big, bold statement as well. And we've mentioned it before at the start of the podcast. Like, this is something that BT haven't done really ever at all. And what's the reaction, shall we say, when you go out to the industry and people are saying, oh, BT, is that didn't know they did that?
Yeah, so I've been at conferences, even in the UK, and you know, the badge will say head of startup scouting Europe, BT, and they're like, BT? And they're thinking, is this like HSBC? Is it a VC? What is it? And I'm like, think about it. Like a British person. I'm like, think about it, who's BT? And they're like, no way. And, you know, one or two sentences in, they're like, oh yeah, that totally makes sense. Why wouldn't BT try and expand from telco to techco? Why wouldn't we try and become the giant techco the UK never created? So it's a learning curve, and we have an amazing comms and marketing team and all the events that the Etcetera team are involved with as well as digital and other parts of BT as well, building it brick by brick, this perception of this innovative player who can do more than is currently perceived. So, yeah.
No, that's so cool. And as you've had this amazing career today as well, I want to talk a little bit about sort of your personal journey. You know, how have you gone through and measured your own success? You know, as you said, started, failed, tried again. How's that come around? You know, what's your, like, what does good look like for Jack?
I think I've always had, since a very young age, a don't let yourself have regrets. So no regrets is something I live by. And I make a lot of decisions based on a simple question, which is, if I don't say yes to this now, will I regret it in years to come? And that's where I think passion can be a liability as well, because there's a trade-off around, I might be safe and secure in this nice cushy job in like Accenture, a little bit thirsty to do something a little bit different. And very much enjoyed what I was doing there. A lot of good friends I still stay in touch with, but there was a hunger for something else. And in terms of measuring success, it's looking back and, you know, knowing that I took advantage of the opportunities that were there. Learning from the mistakes along the way. And I think that unless you, if you haven't failed at something, you haven't tried to do something bold enough. If you've succeeded at every challenge, your challenges aren't good enough. So failure is a badge of honor because it means that you took risks and you've learned to become a better person. So those are kind of some of the things at the back of my mind.
Yeah, and you just mentioned challenges there. What would you perceive as sort of the main challenges that you, number one, you've overcome, and number two, are generally for startups, for example?
Challenges I've overcome? I mean, you know, trying to get a consulting firm that's never done a startup before to spin off a startup. At one point I had The Daily Show with Trevor Noah because it was a fake news thing. Asked us, could we do the State of the Union speech, so Trump's annual speech to Congress. And they asked us, would we do a live thing on their show to live fact check Trump? Now, the risk for a consulting firm to do a satire news show, first of all, is immense. And then you add in the extra factor of potentially calling out, being the reason the president of the United States was called out as being incorrect or saying something wrong. So, you know, like the pitfalls with doing that were immense. And there was a lot of hand-holding and a lot of, again, learning who was against this and what the concerns were and trying to piece by piece build a path forward that was a path that enough stakeholders could come along, and that where you can't get everyone, at least you have some senior people who will swat away but it's some naysayers, you know?
No, yes, exactly. I can relate to that for sure. And
handhold some naysayers.
There you go, yeah. and startups generally, what do you think then challenges some people are listening to this right now, you know, and some people that don't know about startups as well that are listening to this, you know, what are the kind of things that people can kind of empathize with them for?
Yeah, I think startups these days, timing is actually the biggest success factor, I think, in a startup. You can have a great product, a great team, but timing is actually, which is completely out of your control. So again, when you're talking about success in a startup, sometimes it's not your control. You know, you could be too early to something, too late to something. And that's something key to keep in the back of your mind. There's just getting out and meeting people and throwing yourself at opportunities. When I lived in New York for 2 years, I had I get invited or offered or suggested to go along to certain things. And even when I'd be tired, I'd be like, I should do it. Because I might have a regret. So say yes to everything. You don't know what opportunity is going to come your way. It is a bit more difficult for a startup founder, though, because time is extremely precious. A month to someone in a corporate is like a week to the startup. That's the perception of value in terms of time. What the corporate wants to do in a month, a startup needs to do in a couple of days. So it can be a bit more difficult to say yes to everything in that situation. So you have to triage. That's a success factor thing, I think.
And you do a lot of outside of work activities with startups as well. So it's pretty safe to say this isn't a 9-to-5 thing for you as well. Would you like to just touch upon some, you know, you're on a couple of boards as well for Irish startups?
Sure. So I'm on the board of a group called Digital Irish, which is a non-profit funded by the Irish government. Began in New York as a way to help Irish startups break into the New York US corporate ecosystem, where we used to host events, bring some senior business leaders in to give a talk, some startups would pitch afterwards to just share what they're up to, try and get some introductions, not specifically for investment. I used to go along to those events, and every now and then I'd see a startup and be like, hey, I like what you're doing and I want to help them. I'd say, come on up to my office. We're overlooking Madison Square Garden. It's a beautiful view. I'll buy a bag of sandwiches, and I have designers and developers and process engineers and behavioral psychologists, and I'll buy a bag of sandwiches, and my team can have their lunch break, and you tell them what your challenges are, and they'll help give you some pro bono consulting. Startups will get, you know, thousands of dollars of pro bono consulting there, and for me as well. And eventually this group were like, who are you and why are you stealing our startups? And eventually I joined the board, and I got more involved in organizing these events as a hobby in New York, and then I launched it in London in 2019. It's something I really enjoy doing, where helping startups, where, you know, for me, it's like a jigsaw puzzle where someone comes in, they have an idea, they have a product, but they naturally have a challenge because they're not a $100 billion company yet. And so they can take it or leave it, but here's a suggestion, here's my thinking, or maybe I can give an introduction. And it's very little amount of, it's a very small amount of my time. And sometimes it's very helpful for those startups. So there's a number that I mentor, I really enjoy doing that. And it's become this weird space where my hobby is kind of almost my day job now. Yeah. As people say, you're one way to kill a hobby or to kill the passion for your hobby is to make it your job. But so far, so good. So.
No, that's so cool. And as we kind of sort of approaching the end of the pod for today, I just want to touch upon your key learnings, because, you know, you've done all of these amazing things. You know, if you could pick a couple of things that you've, you know, really learned about yourself or companies, what would they be?
There's a few things where the four fits framework, simple tests around making sure that you have a product which is strategically fit in key areas. There's a pricing strategy, the Van Westendorp pricing strategy approach, which I think for anyone doing pricing is I share that with startups. They love it. There is Bullseye is a book. I think it's the title of the book, or it's the framework anyway, for growth strategies. There's a couple of startups I've recommended that to. They love it. Those are some simple things I've shared with startups. But I think, you know, one of the things I've learned throughout my career is pay it forward. So I help out of interest, but also altruism and a genuine desire to see great little startups and their founders succeed. I will invest my own time personally and in trying to help and guide these companies, because I really enjoy it. But paying it forward is something that I think I've seen things come back in spades, and people inviting me to things because, or asking me to attend things because I've helped other things. So I don't do it because of that, but I think paying it forward is something I would say to everyone. Have no regrets and pay it forward are like the two philosophies I live by.
That's amazing, Jack. And just want to thank you for coming on today's episode of At Digipod, the 1 year special going externally at Wembley Stadium. We've done a good job considering the noise behind us is pretty intense. We're relaying a pitch if anyone's wondering what that sound is. I also want to thank our studio audience. Thank you all for coming. Give yourself a round of applause. Jack, you're an absolute legend, man. And
thanks for having me.
We'll do this again soon. Yep. Cheers, everyone.
Thank you.
Ha ha.